Almighty God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, we ask your blessing upon us this afternoon. Please keep our hearts and eyes and ears open to you. Guide us. Guide our thoughts. That we always remember you, know what you did and why you did it. Please help us understand how it applies to us in our lives and what we must learn from it. We praise you, God, and ask for your blessing. In the name of your Son, Yeshua HaMashiach. Amen.
2 Samuel chapter 1. Shaul had died, and David had been 2 days in Ziklag after returning from the slaughter of the Amalekites. On the third day, there came a man from Shaul's camp with his clothes torn and earth on his head. He approached David, fell to the ground, and prostrated himself. David said to him, "Where are you coming from?" "I escaped from the camp of Israel," he replied. "Tell me, please, how did things go?" asked David. "The people have fled the battle," he answered, "and many of them are wounded or dead. Shaul and Jonathan, his son, are dead too." David asked the young man who had told him this, "How do you know that Shaul and Jonathan, his son, are dead?" The young man who had told him said, "I happened to be on Mount Gilboa when I saw Shaul leaning on his spear. The chariots and cavalry were bearing down on him. He looked behind him, saw me, and called to me. I answered, 'Here I am.' He said to me, 'Who are you?' And I answered, 'I am an Amalekite.' He said to me, 'I'm in agony, and I'm going to die, but I'm still alive. So please stand next to me and kill me.' So I stood next to him and killed him, because I was sure he was so badly wounded that he couldn't live. I took the crown that was on his head and the bracelet on his arm and have brought them here to my lord." Then David took hold of his clothes and tore them, and likewise all the men who were with him. They wailed and cried, and they fasted until evening for Shaul, for Jonathan his son, for Yahweh's people and for the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. David said to the young man who had told him, "Where are you from?" He answered, "I'm the son of a foreigner, an Amalekite." David asked him, "How is it that you weren't afraid to raise your hand to destroy Yahweh's anointed?" David called one of his young men and said, "Go over to him and kill him." The man struck him down and he died. David said to him, "Your blood is on your own head. Your own mouth convicted you when you said, 'I killed Yahweh's anointed.'" Then David pronounced this lament over Shaul and over Jonathan his son, in order to teach the people of Yehuda not to underestimate archery. The lament has been written down in the book of Yasher. "Your glory, Israel, lies dead on your high places. How the heroes have fallen. Don't speak of it in Gath. Don't proclaim it in the streets of Ashkelon. Then the daughters of the Philistines won't rejoice. The daughters of the uncircumcised won't gloat. Mountains of Gilboa, may there be on you no dew, no rain, no fields with good crops. Because there the shields of the heroes were dishonored. The shield of Shaul was no longer rubbed with oil. From the blood of the dead, from the flesh of heroes, from the bow of Jonathan did not retreat, or the sword of Shaul return unsatisfied. Shaul and Jonathan, loved and gracious while alive, were not separated even in death. They were swifter than eagles, stronger than lions. Daughters of Israel, weep over Shaul. He clothed you luxuriously in scarlet and put gold jewelry on your clothing. How the heroes have fallen in the heat of battle. Jonathan killed on your high places. I grieve for you, my brother Jonathan. You meant so much to me. Your love for me was deeper than the love of women. how the heroes have fallen and the weapons of war perished.
Thank you. That was 2 Samuel chapter 1. Any comments, questions? That caught your attention about this particular chapter. Yes.
Yeah, I just had a comment about, you know, the love that David and Jonathan, how it was beyond, you know what I mean, a man and a woman.
Right.
And how that, you know, I don't know if I've ever had a brother, you know, like that, to be honest with you.
It is. I've gone through 1 Samuel. We were trying to explore a little bit the relationship they had with one another. It appeared as far as the two of them were so closely connected, is that they would do something to benefit the opposite person to their own detriment. You're placing somebody else greater than yourself. In David's case, he placed himself in greater detriment, trying to help Jonathan out. And Jonathan, of course, many times the same thing for David, though it would cost Jonathan his throne, of course, now obviously his life. It is a unique relationship set up that way. Yes.
I think it kind of mirrors the love a man would have with Yeshua and a woman also. I mean, I would say the love I have for Yeshua is deeper than the love I have for my husband. I mean, it's kind of a picture, isn't it? Because if you're going to take David as a messianic figure and Jonathan, so it's kind of a picture, I think.
However, I agree.
Want to add, because what I was going to say, do you know that the Christian gay movement uses this scripture. Yeah.
Yeah, I heard about that too a few years ago. They have their own distorted script.
That's kind of like, isn't that from like the sublime to the ridiculous when you're talking about that wonderful intimacy that, because men are the bride of Messiah.
We have the same emotions that God himself built inside of us, that he designed and he has.
Yeah.
There's no difference. To me, the relationship that's parallel between Jonathan and David is also, of course, with the Messiah and John the Baptist. You know, when still in each other's womb, you know, John the Baptist responded when Mary shows up in the door. I mean, that's a unique relationship that cannot be parallel with anybody else. It is highly unusual as far as because I've never experienced it either, just like you have not experienced it that fashion. We are still human beings. We have a tendency to focus upon ourselves. The closest I've had is with a child. That's the closest I've come to that relationship as far as what I desire for my child over anybody else. But that's a one direction still. But yes, Ellie.
Well, I agree with what you said, Susan, and I think that the fact that David is a picture of the Messiah, that Jonathan reflects that love back to David. And there's one thing in this love that does not exist in what you spoke of, and that is honor and respect, because there is no using of each other. This is honor. And David gave the king's son honor and respect, and Jonathan returns that honor. So this is a total opposite of what they're using. It's a shame to see someone sully that with that type of thing.
Yes, Bill.
When this guy kills Saul, Saul asked him to do it.
Yes.
And he's obeying the king's order.
Uh-huh.
So he's between a rock and a hard place. Why David...
We're going to talk about that. This particular individual, what he did, why he did it, David's response to him, justified or not, what should have theoretically happened to this particular person, and why it didn't turn out that way for him. That's going to be probably a majority of our discussion, because it always gets anybody to go, wait a minute, he did exactly what the king ordered, and now he's being punished for doing exactly what the king ordered. Was it a right punishment? Was it fair? Did this guy do something wrong? Should he done, what other choices did he have? Well, we're going to discuss a few of those. At first glance, it appears almost unfair. But we'll deal how the details and what this particular individual knows before he encounters Saul. But we'll discuss that. Any other comments or questions? All right, well, I'll start my little spiel then. Verse 1. First of all, when this chapter begins, this book begins, David has no knowledge of the prophecy regarding Saul and his sons to be died on that battlefield. That was a prophecy that Saul got from the entity that he was talking to, the Lady of Endor. He received the information. The men that were with him received that information. There's a possibility he would have shared that information with his sons. Hard to say for certain. That's a little questionable. But no one else knows this. So it's when David had left the battle of Philistines 3 days earlier, about three or four days earlier, we're quite sure how many days had passed since when he left. When he left the battle there, as far as what's going through David's mind, God of Israel is always with Israel. So this battle is going to happen. Israel will prevail, like it always does. And the Philistines will be humiliated, like it always has been, because that's what God does. So far as he's concerned, this is a no-brainer. He knows, I'm sure he probably figures that some people will die on each side, but overall, Israel will still be victorious. That's what he's expecting to have happen. And of course, if he was at that battle, behind the Philistine lines, there's a good probability that's what the outcome would have been. Because having 600 well-trained soldiers right near the throats of the men in charge, you can do a surprise attack and completely obliterate the Philistine army by demoralizing them to start with. God made sure that scenario didn't happen by getting David out of there. Because God knew what the plan was. God said, all right, Israel's going to lose this. Saul and his sons are going to die here. And that's what God's plan was. He did not disclose that to anybody else. Other than the two men or three men that were with Saul when he was talking to Lady of Endor. Because they obviously heard it as well. So David's expecting a positive report. This gentleman comes. This 2 days, by the way, which I find this interesting, the timeline. Due to the number of days it would take a person to travel 60 miles from Gilboa to Ziklag, it's about 3 days' time. And David is home at Ziklag for 2 days after killing the Amalekites. The Battle of the Amalekites with David is about the same day, if not the same day, as the Battle of the Philistines in Israel. It would have occurred at the same time. So 3 days after that is when David receives this news. We'll discuss the timing in a few moments as we go through some of these verses. So on the third day after killing Saul and Jonathan, this guy comes, of course, on the third day, which is the Amalekite being destroyed at the same time. This gentleman comes to David. He says, of course, I have news. What's going on? He asks what's going on. He's expecting a good report, or sort of receives a very poor one. This gentleman's account of what is occurring differs from 1 Samuel chapter 31. In 1 Samuel 31, it says, the story goes, you can read it yourself if you wish. Saul's talking to his armor bearer. Saul sees there are a large number of Philistines around him. They're destroying him. They're going to kill all the men that are with him. He tells his armor bearer, kill me. At least they find my body. And the armor bearer says, I won't do it. I'm not going to do it. So Saul falls upon his own sword, not spear, sword. The armor bearer, seeing that Saul is dead, use the term dead in Hebrew, he takes his knife and plunges through himself, of course, kills himself at the same time because of the death of his master, death of the king. So both of them theoretically are dead in 31. Now, of course, 2 Samuel chapter 1 comes along, and this gentleman says he's along the field, he sees, he's passing by, we'll discuss all these details in a moment. He sees Saul leaning on his spear, of course, a spear rather than a sword. He sees that Saul calls to him, goes up to him and says, I'm obviously not dead yet. Who are you? He says, I'm a Amalekite. Kill me. Of course, he raises his head. Whether he's got a sword, whatever it is, he kills him. He may have just pushed him further on the spear. Hard to say. Two differing accounts. So which one's right? Why would you think the first one's right versus the second one being right?
Well, it obviously came before the second one. So it would have to be the first one.
Oh, hold on.
It sounds it would be right because, you know, every man like Saul was has an armor bearer.
Correct.
And no man comes to who he's trying to guard without, you know, going through him and him being killed first. At least that's theoretically how it works. So to me, it looks like the first account is more accurate. Amalekites are obviously enemies of Israel, not to be relied upon on that token as well.
Mm-hmm.
Could be others.
Susan.
Well, the Amalekites were the sworn enemy of Israel.
Yes.
And in Exodus 17, it says that they were to be eternal enemies. In fact, in the end, God was going to blot out every remembrance of them. And so I'm just wondering that he was not thinking he was taking some sort of honor onto himself, whether there was some pleasure in announcing that he had killed the king of Israel, and whether or not David, he would even think David, he'd done David a favor. Initially. But I think it's definitely connected to the fact that they are enemies.
We'll discuss more details on their enemy status as well. Bill?
Now, what Richard said earlier, what Elohim shows us on a physical plane, he has a spiritual meaning. How did this come into play here?
Part of this story comes into play on that level, which I don't want to talk about just yet. I want to discuss the physical stuff first. Then we're going to go back and rediscuss what the spiritual plane and aspects they are and how they point to Messiah itself in a few moments. One task at a time. The physical is easier to talk about. The spiritual takes a little more time to explain. Pat.
Oh, kind of on what Sue said. This man came thinking he was going to tell David something and probably be rewarded for it, because in his mind, because David had been out of Israel and was on the run, he thought he would get honor for doing what he did and be rewarded as opposed to killed.
That's a common belief. One of the reasons they believe that he believed being honored, because when he found Saul dead, who did he go to first? Well, why would you go to David to tell him? Why don't you just go to, you know, somebody else? Why him? Why would he be the one to go off and arrive to David? Why just send word, by the way, Saul's dead? Which would imply he was desiring some kind of, to ingratiate himself.
Did they also know that David was going to be the next king?
Most of the southern tribe, Judah, knew that and believed that. Not everybody in the northern tribes believed that David should be or would be king. We'll discuss that more with Abner, Saul's general, as he goes and finds Saul's one remaining son, can't think of his name off the top of my head, and makes him king. While David becomes king of Judah, the other guy becomes king of the rest of the tribes. So it divides the kingdom for a few years. Not very long, just a few years. Yes, Ellie.
I can't imagine you talking about which report is true. If Saul were dying and he wasn't yet dead, do you really think that he's going to ask an Amalekite to kill him? He would lay there and suffer as his blood drained out before he would have his enemy get the power over him to have killed him. No. He would have fallen on his own sword.
Which he did.
He would have done whatever he had to do. But he wouldn't have let an Amalekite kill him.
That's
Ellie, unless it was irony.
Irony?
Irony, because didn't Saul fail to wipe out the Amalekite?
Oh,
yeah, but he... It's all
about... Just run.
Poetic. Could we like poetic justice?
But you don't bring poetic justice on yourself.
No, baby, God does.
Poetic justice. Yes, Phil.
Just one more. You said even Elohim had said this is going to happen. He and his sons would die on this in this battle.
That was the plan. That was the intention of God. So, the spirit that was talking to Saul is the one actually informed him of this. But because the spirits themselves don't have the authority to kill an individual, especially an anointed of God, without God's permission, it would have had to have gone through God saying, yes, he's going to die in this instance. Now, who told who, what, when, We're not discussing how the spirit world talks to each other. I don't deal with that. They don't have cell phones. I don't know what else they got, but they got something up there. They talk and somehow communicate information back and forth, and somebody figured something out, so they knew Saul was going to be killed, Saul and his sons.
So this guy's got at least one thing going for him, that the Almighty was going to have him die anyway. I mean, maybe he was fulfilling the will out.
Say it again. Maybe
this one that killed Saul was carrying out God's
will.
Will.
Possible. It is, but since Saul had fallen on the sword, this gentleman who witnessed it said, "All right, you are dying. You clearly would not live through this particular wound," and we don't know how detailed the wound was. Whether or not this Amalekite had to do it, or somebody, or he was going to die on his own, either way, God's will would still have been fulfilled. Having Amalekite do it, poetic justice, I can see that in detail. But we're discussing a little bit about what more David knows about this guy and about these two chapters. Because David knows something that we don't usually think about, the fact that he knows. Yes, Richard.
Thinking about, not just he wanted a reward, I think they wanted alliance with. That the Amalekites were looking for an alliance with this, with David.
With David.
So they can go to war together. At least they wouldn't be at war with one another. Taking advantage of the downside. That's my thinking. I may be wrong.
Yes, Carrie.
I just thought it was distinctly interesting that, because I had thought about Agag also. And Saul didn't kill Agag, so Samuel did.
Right.
And then the very next king has the opportunity to save an Amalekite again. And it distinctly seems like a test. I mean, he comes with Saul's, you know,
crown and his bracelet.
And he, you know, and so obviously it looks like there's some kind of alliance, you know, probably secretly trying to be made. But for what purpose? You know, I mean, basically, I mean, we look down in history and you get to Esther and you've got an Agagite.
Right.
You know, trying to wipe out the Jews. And so it's, I don't know. It was like, oh, here's another note where they're trying to do it again. And even if they did make an alliance, what would be the fallout if David had fallen for it? It just distinctly looks like a test to me.
A test
among
from God.
The other things going on, but.
It very well could be a test from God. It's hard to say for certain. David just got back from killing a whole bunch of Amalekites, this guy's relatives. Now, maybe not direct, you know, immediate, but some of our relatives. And he has no knowledge of it, because he was in the middle of a battle up north. So just got back there. So David's killing of Amalekites is perfectly okay with him. So that's not necessarily an issue. I also, because you brought it up, Saul was assigned to kill off all the Amalekites, right? And, of course, let Agag live. Well, then where did all the rest of the Amalekites come from? Because Agag didn't have, probably 400 men at least got away from David. He didn't have that many children in about 20 years' time. That's a lot of kids. So Saul's assignment to kill Amalekites was not to wipe out all Amalekite race, per se. It appears the assignment was right to wipe out the section or group of Amalekites that were associated with what happened with Moses in the coming out of Exodus. Because obviously this Amalekite, and he tells David, he is from a father who is dwelling in Israel. They were not dwelling amongst their brethren. They were dwelling amongst Israelites for probably beneficial reasons. They're probably treated better, just personal opinion. Or they disagreed with their brethren. Hard to say for certain. I'm a little bit faster along here, so I don't want to cut too many of you off, but this is kind of important here. Who wrote 1 Samuel, the end of the book? Who wrote it down? Did Samuel write it down? No, he was dead. Who wrote it down? David? David's men? Any comments? No? Yeah, scribe? David's own men would have recounted this, because there's too many details. It's only a conversation between David and one other person. And the conversation is recorded. So David had to relay the conversation. So, many years, project yourself a few years from this point into the future. David is recording, as a memory, 1 Samuel chapter 31, the details about Saul's death. He's also recording 1 Samuel chapter 31 and 2 Samuel chapter 1, recording the details. Why would he have his men record two different stories down? He knows the truth of the first number 31, and he knows the details of the second one. He wrote both, had his men or scribes write down both accounts. So David has two accounts of the same information, the same details. He's of course recalling this probably a few years later when he actually becomes king. Why would he write both of them down? What reason? What purpose? If David, writing it down years later, has knowledge of both, which one do you think he believed? The first one. The second one, he records this, your words are on your head. You claims to kill the first anointed of God. End of story. David appears to believe the Amalekite is lying. Because David's writing this information down later. And he's writing it down in this fashion that we currently read. So my inclination is, yeah, chapter 31 is probably more accurate. This gentleman, which also brings the question, why was he wandering amongst the middle of a battle, not armed, not with any other purpose, not on either side, just in the middle of a battle, no fear. Oh, look, hey, look, there's Saul. How interesting. Why is he not fearful of the Philistines who are coming through and Saul's trying to die before they get to him? What's he walking around there for? Is he not fearful of the Philistines killing him because he happens to be right there on the battle line? It's because he wasn't there during the battle. Most likely, this gentleman was coming along pillaging the dead corpses. Ran across Saul, ran across Saul's sons, took the crown, took the bracelet, and ran. That's most likely what had occurred. Yes, your hand was up.
Oh, I just thought it said somewhere in here that he was a prisoner of Israel or something. No,
sojourner.
Oh, okay.
A convert. Son of a convert of Israel. Somebody, now, they're not sure. The word convert actually can be taken, the Hebrew word, both ways. Whether you actually converted into the religion or you're just dwelling there as a visitor. Both are, it's the same word. The debate for us, what he actually is, whether he's the son of an actual religiously converted person or son of somebody who's just living there. Nobody really knows for sure. So it's a little bit odd if David's recording this information down, what he actually knows and learns about this Amalekite as he's recalling the conversations. So my opinion, I believe 31 was probably more accurate. The first chapter of Samuel chapter 2 is most likely this guy's lying, just based on what David wrote down. David could have easily written down 31 as Saul was dying, but not dead, past tense. He could have written that down if he knew that the Amalekite was telling the truth. But he didn't. It was written down as Saul was dead. Already dead. So what else did David know about this particular individual? Well, in verse 13, David asks him a couple more questions. David already knew he was an Amalekite, but David asked, of course, after he tears his clothes, they're all mourning for the loss of Israel, the loss of Saul. He asked him, where are you from? In fact, I'm a son of Amalekite convert. The gentleman seems to give more details as David asks. So I mentioned before, convert, whether he's religiously or just living, it's hard to say for certain. But it allows David to instantly know more information about him. Because whether he's living with Israel, via just living there, or whether he's a converted person, he knows more Jewish law and rules than somebody just walking past. And killing an anointed of God is against the rules. So this man would have already known that he was breaking the law by killing Saul, in spite of the king's order to do so. So he asked him this, of course. After David found out he was from a convert or a sojourner, how could you not be afraid to send forth your hand to destroy the anointed one of Israel? You knew better, Amalekite. You knew you weren't supposed to do that. David, in previous chapters, threatened his own men. If you kill Saul, I will kill you. His own men tried to kill Saul. And David said, no, you don't get to do that. You're Israelites. You know better. You don't get to do that. This individual also knew better, being either a sojourner via somebody living there or whether he converted, he still knew better. So David, after learning this information about this particular Amalekite, now I know you knew what the law was. You knew you weren't supposed to do this. Yes, Holly.
If he knew better, then why wouldn't he just tell the truth and say, I came looking for stuff and I found him dead. There he was dead, and I'm bringing his crown to you. Why wouldn't he just say that?
That was the question which we had discussed just a few moments ago, when the fact that he's appeared to be in trying to ingratiate himself, tried to say, hey, look, I have killed your enemy. Please like me, essentially. Let's make a deal. Let's make associates. Somehow that appeared to be his goal or his intention. Bill.
David had a couple opportunities to kill Saul, and he didn't.
Yeah, and he didn't.
His own men were wanting him to, and he said, no, I'm not going to.
Exactly.
Kill him.
He didn't do it. He wouldn't let his men do it.
Yeah.
David being willing to kill his own men, how much more so would he kill an Amalekite who actually did do it? Yes, Ellie.
I don't know if there's a scriptural reference to an Amalekite telling someone the truth without something attached.
Without strings attached? Yeah, I don't know.
Know
I haven't tried to look at that. I'm not sure. We don't run across too many Amalekites' words, at least,
what they say. Well, Edom and Esau, I mean, the scriptures is pretty divided. The Torah is divided. These are the good guys and these are the bad guys. And God assigned people to play the parts, and he'll sort out the stuff later. But for right then, I don't know of an Amalekite.
That has told the truth.
Unless it was a prophecy about something where he was going to turn out to be a bad guy.
Hard to say.
I don't know.
I hadn't thought about that, so I don't know. I don't think I have a comment on that. Yes, Jeff.
So what do we have? Like an uncircumcised Philistines lying Amalekites?
That works. So now come to Bill's question. This guy was following the king's order to kill him. Why is it that David killed him? Where was the trial? Where was the second witness that this guy actually did what he said he did? Why did David bypass the Torah laws regarding this subject matter? Yes, Terry.
Because if David hadn't said something and done something, then people would have presumed that David did find favor with what he's claiming to have done. And that's, David went through such pains not to kill Saul, not to let anybody else kill Saul, that if he had accepted this Amalekite's word and sent him on his way with no punishment, then that would have been seen as acknowledging that this man did something that was okay with him. And he could not let that happen. He's the future king of Israel. He could not let that happen.
Very well said. Absolutely right. Absolutely right. There's more details than just that, but that's the core of it. David is now going to become king, and he knows. He knew it long before he was going to become king. When, he didn't quite know, but he knew he was going to become king one day. He had already threatened to kill his own men. It is more vitally important for all of Israel to even accept him as a king, to go ahead and actually extract the punishment upon this Amalekite for doing the one thing that David said he would kill his own men for. Now, second witness. Did this guy have a second witness? Normally, you don't kill a death penalty or an execution is not done. Oh, sorry. So you had your hand up?
Yeah, I just see something else in there. It just, thy blood be upon thy head.
Yes.
It's kind of what Israel said when they killed the Lord's anointed. Right?
Yes.
His blood be upon us and upon our children.
Yes.
Be they had killed the Lord's anointed. It's kind of a little prophetic echo there, I think.
I'm going to jump through this last comment so I can get back to that whole point, because I want to discuss the spiritual aspect of this, which I've been trying to avoid so far, because it's really important. Okay, normally there's a second witness for a death penalty. Was this guy have a second witness? Did he have any kind of witnesses at all that verified he did any of this? No. He did have circumstantial evidence that he had the crown, the bracelet, which corroborated that at least he was there with Saul's body or near it. Is that sufficient for a death penalty? No. Did David care?
No.
Trial. Was there a trial? Sort of. This man testified in the presence of all of David's men and himself, David being the judge, that he did this act and he verified after requesting, you did it, you admitted it, okay? Unlike our current system, which we say just because you confess doesn't mean you did it. Well, in their rules, I'm sorry, if you're dumb enough to confess, you did it, and then you're going to be punished for it. So you could argue there was a slight trial, so I'll give David some credit for that. Whether this man deserved a more accurate trial or not, I don't really care. He's dead, so that's his problem. Okay. That's most of the interesting stuff. So, I have to talk about that too, don't I? I think I have enough time. I think so. All right, David's, I should tell this, David's, his psalm they wrote, the lament. Of course, I'm not going to go through the entire thing because it's pretty self-explanatory what he's discussing. But, of course, no, Gilboa, everybody's heard the curse of Gilboa. Oh, and he curses Gilboa, and of course, what happens? Gilboa does produce some flowers, but that's pretty much all it produces now, with the little bit of rain it gets. Whether it produced anything more than that, hard to say. Some have argued that this curse of David was pronounced upon the Mount Gilboa, and thus God fulfilled it. Whether or not God fulfilled it before that, and David just reiterating the curse, hard to say. We don't know. Gilboa is a pretty rocky place. It does produce flowers, though. But note, David said no dew, no rain, but also no bountiful crops, no edible things, things which you would harvest. It does not produce harvestable items. It was wildflowers, that's about it, not very many of them at that. It's usually dead pretty much year-round. So, he is prophesying a little bit. Verse 22, I like this, I like Jonathan, I have to talk about this. Jonathan's bow would not return without spilling blood. It would not recoil. I like this one statement because it cuts two ways. Discussing and honoring Jonathan's bow. That Jonathan would not recoil without spilling blood, but also not recoil from blood. If Israel's dying, Israel's men are being slaughtered, does Jonathan run? No. His bow does not recoil either Israeli blood or Philistine blood by spilling it or having the blood around it being spilled. He fought to the end. He and Saul, of course, he speaks very highly of Saul. Ladies, women, lament for the losses, all the wonderful royal things you've gotten, the jewelry, the various things of that nature. Saul was successful in every battle he went to. He plundered his enemies and brought all those wonderful things back to the men and back to the families. So women actually had received quite a bit of monetary value, as well as physical food, from all the various battles that Saul went to. They have a lot to sing about his praises. This is a great contrast to the previous time when David first showed up with Goliath and they were singing about Saul's praises, but then thought, wow, David has tens of thousands that he's killed. Which, of course, infuriated Saul. But that's a separate issue. We already discussed that. The one statement I want to point out, which I find... So I didn't know this, but I didn't think about this. How the mighty have fallen... The weapons of war gone to waste. Last verse, 37. What weapons of war is he talking about? He's talking about Saul and Jonathan. Those two are the weapons of war that went to waste. Because they died. Not talking about their bows or their swords, their spears in particular. It's those two individuals. The whole thing is about how the mighty have fallen. The two most important people, they're the ones who have died. They are your weapons of war, Israel. They were everything about you. They made you who you were. It's very heartfelt for somebody who had the enemy of Saul. It's a wonderful contrast that David's enemy is who David sings about his praises. Saul wanted David dead. Everybody knew Saul wanted David dead. And what does David return upon Saul? Blessing. Love. It brings to mind the whole love your enemy. My argument, that's where it comes from. David loved his enemy. We think of enemy, oh, well, the Philistines were the enemy. No, Philistines were Israelites' enemy. Saul was David's enemy. So I have to ask you, does the Messiah love his enemy? Who is his enemy? We are his friends. We are his enemy. Our leadership, our individuals, we are the enemy of him, and yet he loves us still. Card of mine. Now, let's go back a little bit. Because David is a Messiah type figure, this actual chapter has to do with a lot about Messiah and what he receives. David receives the crown of Saul on the third day. What does Messiah receive on his third day?
Resurrection.
Resurrection. He's lifted up, isn't he? Is David now lifted up? Ah. He has received the kingdom from God. He did get lifted up. He has to go get it, but he received the authority of it. So David was lifted up on the third day from being the son-in-law to God's anointed official king. Yes, Holly.
I see another little parallel.
There's a couple more.
The millennia, the seven millennia, and how Jesus did his work 2,000 years ago. And here we are on the cusp of the third 1,000 years. And so if he was raised up, before anybody discovered him, he did his work of resurrection before they came in the morning. So we may be right on the cusp of him setting his kingdom up for his Sabbath, the 1,000 years. It's a parallel picture there.
Yes, it is a parallel picture. There's a couple of things along those lines. We'll get to all of them. There's a couple of things along those lines. In that each one of the issues that happened in David's life when it seemed to focus around a deliverance or a deliverer out of something, it associates with our Messiah. And, of course, the timing associates with that as well. There's a little bit more about here, which I want to talk about. As I mentioned a couple of, when I was discussing chapter 31, we were going through it in more detail. On the third day, usually means something in particular in the Bible. On the third day or by the third day, someone lives and someone dies. That's pretty much universal. There's a third event, third week, third month, third day, someone lives, someone dies. Which is designed to point us to the Messiah on the third day. Somebody lives and someone dies. Now with the Messiah, who lived and who died? Well, the three men that were with him, one lived and one died. Sorry, two men. Sorry, three men total. But two men with him. One lived and one died. Because one believed him. And one didn't. And he declared, "You'll be with me. You won't." Spiritually. I'm not sorry, physical death. I'm sorry, spiritual death. This particular event, who lived and who died? Who was supposed to live and who was supposed to die? The Amalekites died. This is the event of the battle. The Amalekites died. Were they supposed to die? Yes. But in his visitation of the Amalekites, what did he run across? A servant who was supposed to die but didn't on that same day. On that same day with Jonathan and Saul, who was supposed, with Israel and Philistines, who was supposed to live and who was supposed to die? Israel was supposed to live and Philistines were supposed to die because God's with Israel. But the person who was supposed to live, lived. Or didn't live. The person who was supposed to die, the Philistines, lived. They were flipped. Things get flipped around on the third day. It's important to remember that because it happens all the time in the Bible. With Jonathan and Saul, who was supposed to live and who was supposed to die? Jonathan had to die because he was a descendant of Saul. Saul had to die because God declared it. But being an anointed of God, they are supposed to both live. And they didn't. A count of three with God allows us to distinguish, all right, something important is happening with this count of three. A life and death scenario has occurred. We are to choose the life aspect of it and not the death aspect of it. We're supposed to remember those events. They affect us in our life. When the Messiah on the third day, he was supposed to be dead, but yet he lived. That's not supposed to happen. It can't happen unless God intervenes. With Jonathan and Saul, on the third day, they're the anointed ones of God, the anointed ones of Israel. The men who were supposed to live didn't live. God cut away the few aspects of people that he had raised up. He had lifted them up into their position, raised them up amongst all the other heathen or all the other people, and then he executed them. Is that a fair God? Is that a good God? Why? Why is that fair? Why is that good? Why is it being a chosen of God means he's going to kill you? Why is being anointed of God meaning, oh, okay, I will be anointed, thank you, now I get to go die. God's going to go kill me now. And that's supposed to be a good thing. Why is that a good thing? Why is that acceptable? Israel being chosen, what happened to them over their entire lifetime? All the descendants of Israel. They got slaughtered back and forth. All the anointed of God, what happened to all of them? The prophets, what happened to them? Stones, dead, slaughtered. Is it a good thing to be selected by God? Why?
Because his ways are not our ways, his thoughts are not our thoughts, and he has a plan of redemption, which is why he says, don't be afraid of those who can kill the body. Be afraid of those who have the power to cast body and soul into hell, into death.
Holly, you had your hand up?
It makes me think of the parable about the seed and how the seed has to die in order for it to grow
into
something, what it's meant to be. And so, anyway, I'm not sure exactly.
No, that's a fair.
I think there's a parallel there, too, that Jesus was actually teaching, reminding people that knew these stories, all the stories of, you know, there's a system here that is consistent throughout all creation.
Did your hand up?
Yeah. I've heard it said, if you don't have anything worth dying for, you don't have anything worth living for.
Both you have your hands up.
I was just going to say, you know, the Messiah said, they persecuted me first, you know, and in this world you're going to be persecuted like I did. And I think it's just the economy of God, the way, and the whole thing that you guys said about something has to die unless a grain of wheat falls to the ground and dies. And like the prophets of old, the Messiah himself, all of them persecuted. It's just the way he made it.
Jeff, you had your comment?
One of the things that I said is that, and John talked about, that people love darkness more than light. And that is the continual story over and over again. And in the book of Hebrews, it talks about all the great patriarchs and such. And said, you know, the world was not worthy of them. Because they were coming in and basically they were big party poopers. Because people were like to live in their delusion. And when truth comes into a delusion, people get angry.
Well said. Bill?
Now, this is just my opinion.
Go right ahead. We're having an open discussion right now.
If you know the Father and Son, and you know you belong to them, if you're in a life and death situation where they're going to take your head, or they're going to drown you, or whatever, they're going to feed you the alligators, I don't think you're going to have that fear that people that don't know the Father and Son are going to have. I mean, they're going to be in terror. They're going to be soiling their linen compared to those that, I'm not saying it could be, though, but that's what I think. You're going to have a certain peace that they're not going to have.
Hope. Exactly. Two more comments. I'm going to conclude my little, my concluding statement.
Everybody dies.
Yes.
I mean, everybody that ever lived dies.
Yes.
So dying is no great big deal.
Right.
But if you seek to save your life, you'll die.
If you are
willing to give your life, then you live. The trick is to understand the perspective and not die a bad death.
An ungodly death. Carrie?
I just think it's glorious no matter what your demise, to be on the winning side. It sounds terrible, but one of my favorite things every once in a while is to have a debate with somebody that I know I'm already smarter than. And, I mean, it sounds terrible, but seriously, you think about it, and, you know, sometimes the way to win an argument is to not say anything at all. And the fool thinks they have to have the last word. And Proverbs says, don't answer a fool according to its folly, but it also says, answer a fool according to his folly. And God just is the extremely, just the top of strategists in existence. And whatever he does with you, why does it matter if you know that he's winning? And whether in death or in life, whatever impact he affords you to have on the people, the other people that he has chosen in the future, what does it matter?
It doesn't.
This is the one I really wanted to get at is, it says Romans 8, it talks about how the carnal man and the spirit, they're at enmity with one another.
Right.
And it says in verse 7, for the mind controlled by the old nature is hostile to God.
Yes.
Because it does not submit itself to God's law. Indeed, it cannot. So I think that's the flesh and the spirit. You've seen that with the prophets of old all the way back. It talks about in another passage how the flesh always wars against the spirit. And to be, carnally minded or flesh minded is death. But I'm thinking of Stephen, they gnashed at him with teeth and ran at him. These are carnally minded people that gnashed and they went after him because they couldn't rebuke him or even answer back any of Stephen's words. And he kind of representing the spirit, if you will, because it's not by might nor by power like the flesh does, but it's by his spirit. And his ways are peaceful, the fruit of the spirit and such.
I want to conclude with that type of idea for a moment. Because as we're going through the story between David and Saul, and they were fighting back and forth, they're having issues, well, more like one-sided fight. But in the case with Saul, I pegged pretty hard against him. I slammed him on for slaughtering all the priests, slammed him for failure to listen to God. I went against him for all the various screwed-up things he did. The obeying the will of the people instead of the will of God, so what was right. The one thing he did right is when he knew his moment had come. I'm going to die. He knows because the Spirit told him he was going to die. He and his sons were going to die. And what did he choose to do? To die. He didn't run. He didn't tell his sons, flee for your lives. He knew full well, being the anointed of God, knowing full well he was going to die the following day. He had the moment, he had the opportunity, which he had always had before. When he had knowledge of God, he used it to his advantage, to his own personal advantage. This last moment in his life, he didn't. Being anointed of God, David knows full well, is a dangerous thing. Meaning, you're going to die for it, and God's probably going to be the one who's going to kill you for it. Because you're probably going to screw up. And when you screw up, unlike somebody who's not anointed, God doesn't take kindly to it. Remember Eli and his sons? When you screw up, it's a lasting effect. God doesn't forgive you all, wink my eye. You really didn't mean it, because I need you for more stuff. No, it's held against you permanently. David knows this, Saul knows this. And at this moment in time, when David is lamenting, pretending the Messiah is the one who's lamenting, he's lamenting for, though Saul made his mistakes, though Saul did things that were evil, abhorrent, unacceptable, worthy of the death penalty for he and his whole family, the one moment in time when he could have saved his own skin, he then understood what it means to be an anointed of God. To go through it anyway. That's the most difficult task all of us are assigned. Yes, Susan.
Just for this very reason, I was just reading yesterday, because that Saul did go out to die, and David's recollection, just as you have shared with us, that in rabbinic thought, the very early rabbis said that Saul was counted worthy of Gan Eden and a place in the resurrection.
He repented before his death. The very act that he heard the prophecy, whoever it was from.
Whatever
it was from, but went out and fought and died. They say that is that, well, really, it's, you just put it into words very well, I think, the thought of that, that Saul was not consigned to death, but he was a repentant sinner.
He repented.
Yeah.
David, I think, learned from this, from Saul's life, very much so. Because I remember when I started out, David and his scribes, his men, they're the ones who are writing most of this information down. So they recorded what Saul knew. They recorded what Saul found out, when they had found out about it. And he recorded the fact that Saul went out and did it anyway. May the Messiah say the same of us. May at our one moment when we're supposed to be tested, may we not fall back and say, I can't do this. May we obey and repent and follow Saul's lead and say, yeah, all these wonderful, terrible things and all the things that happened in my life, I am going to be repaid horribly for because I probably deserve it. But this one event, this one moment in time, in my day of judgment, the third day has arrived. I will choose the anointed of God to follow God's will. Though I will live through it and I will die through it. The count of three, your days of judgment, that's the point which you choose. I know this is going to kill part of me, but I trust that I will follow through and live on the other side of it. That's what it means to be an anointed of God. Is it scary? Well, in some ways it is. Will it probably kill us all? Yes, most likely it will. But that's what we're supposed to walk through. That's what David is learning as God teaches him. May we all learn that lesson. Have a wonderful rest of Shabbat.